Seven Parables and Three Women.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned your subject is history. Some say, oh, how dry. If you say your subject is prophecy, oh, how exciting. We like to be interested in prophecy. But history is dry. But what's prophecy? History, written in advance. The two subjects are very intricately entwined, one with the other. And our talk today is of a prophetic nature. It's an area that we've gone over, and many speakers have gone over from different perspectives on many occasions. The history of the Christian Church. We're going to be looking at this history mainly to notice certain patterns that develop in the prophetic handling of church history, as the New Testament writers particularly, and even the Old Testament pictures, foresaw the conditions of the gospel age. There are certain patterns that develop. Our remarks will be divided into three areas. First, we're going to do just a little bit of historical review. Get the boring stuff done first. Then, after we do that, we want to notice a pattern in how this history develops in three perspectives, and how this perspective is shown in a series of seven parables in the Bible. And then third, we're going to look at the same thing from the aspect of one allegory from the Old Testament, an allegory that involves three women instead of a division of seven. So we'll take our step one at a time. Down the middle of our chart, for those who can see it, it may be a little too small for those in the back row. I'm not sure if you can see it there, so I'll repeat the information that's on the chart. But down the middle, we have a number of dates that are mentioned. And these dates are not arbitrary. These dates are selected for very specific purposes. And they divide the gospel age into eight periods of time. You'll notice seven numbers there, but you'll notice the word number five is repeated twice. And there's a reason for that also. We'll get to that when we come down to number five. We'll just mention what the dates are and what the significant events are at those dates, and then we'll start developing our theme from that. 33 AD, of course, is the date we all know. That's the date of the beginning of the Christian Church. That's when you have the day of Pentecost and you find the actual church starting to develop. The year 150, and that one is more of an approximate date than an actual date, is a time period that is marked by two events. One is purely secular, and the other is purely religious. In 135 AD, you find the final fall of Jerusalem in the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, a fall that was even more significant than the fall 65 years earlier under Titus in 70 AD that we speak so much about. But the Bar Kokhba fall affected almost twice as many people and was certainly more prominent, and was the fall from which the Jews date the main part of their diaspora. So much so that when Theodor Herzl in 1896 issued the call for the first Zionist Congress, in each invitation letter, there was a replica coin of Bar Kokhba minting. And the theme was, remember Bar Kokhba. The Bar Kokhba rebellion was the final separation between Judaism and Christianity. Up to Bar Kokhba, Christianity was considered a branch of Judaism, a branch that was still very much within the overall line of Jewish thought. But after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the Christians would no longer accept this definition, and they completely separated themselves from the Jewish people as a religious group. Starting in 150, on to about 185, you have a very strong religious element that connects with this, and that is the canonization of the Bible. The acceptance of the Bible into the form that we have it today, basically the 27 books of the New Testament. When I say canonization of the Bible, I really mean the development of a New Testament canon of the 27 books, and that was over a period of time through a period of councils that ended in about 185 when the Bible finally was there, and is probably the event that is predicted in 1 Corinthians 13 when he says, when that which is perfect is come, when that which is mature, the mature church, having the Bible as a new tool to replace merely the Old Testament. This gives you your first major division point then, the average between them, 150, between the first development of the early church. Then you come into a growth period of the early church that lasted roughly 175 years to 325. 325 was the year of the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Council, the Nicene Creed. It was the conversion of Constantine, or at least the so-called conversion of Constantine. And it was when Christianity became associated with state, and state began controlling the religious, the secular power over the religious. A very strong, important date in the development of church history. The development of church and state relations went through two distinct phases. The first phase, from 325 to 539, which is not on the chart, was a period of time in which church and state were united, but there was no question who was boss. The state was in power. They were the Pontifex Maximus. It was the ruler of the country, and that was why Constantine himself played such an important role. In 539, when the Vandals were defeated, and you have the Battle of Ravenna under Belisarius, the general, you find that it was necessary for the Roman Empire, which had by this time divided into two sections. One section in what is today called Constantinople, today called Istanbul, then called Constantinople, and the other headquartered in Rome. The Emperor Justinian was in Constantinople, and he needed somebody to protect the western part of the empire, and he promoted the Pope to do that. And after Belisarius' victory, which was not a victory against pagan tribes, it was a victory against another Christian tribe. The Vandals were Arian Christians. They were followers of Arians in their belief. And so it was a victory over the Arians. It was the establishment of Trinity in its full concept, the last removal of the opposition. That was in 539 between these. Now you have church and state co-partners, equal basis. But in 799, when Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne as the emperor, there is no question that now the church is on top, and you've got church-state with church-state. So really what you have in 325 is you have state-church. In 539, you have church-state. In 799, you have church-state. And the emphasis on the church is being the ruling. Now you have a full setup of papacy in power. 1378 is a very significant date in the development of the papacy, and that was when they showed their first major inability to rule themselves, and you have what is called the Great Eastern Schism. There was a Western Schism that took place earlier, but the Great Eastern Schism was when you had 70-year captivity at Avignon in France, and you had two popes reigning simultaneously. In fact, for part of the time, you had three. You had three popes on the throne. It's also the time of the preaching of Wycliffe, and you have the beginning of a strong protesting voice beginning to develop. A pre-Reformation period goes from 1378 to 1517. 1517, you've got a very definite event. That's Luther putting the thesis on the door, calling attention to a reform that was already in progress, but now was taking off with greater steam and became known as the Reformation. Our second to last date, 1648. Really the end of the Reformation. From 1517, Europe became very much a divided house. As Protestants gained more and more activity and power, there became open warfare between the Protestant kings and the Catholic kings. And it was a political warfare as well as religious. Finally, the warfare was settled in 1648 with the Treaty of Westphalia, which divided Europe into Protestant and Catholic sections. Now Protestantism was established. In 1874, we believe, was the Lord's return at a time of judgment of the whole church. So let's review quickly. Today, you've got the development of the early church from 33 to 150. You've got a growth period for the early church from 150 to 325. Both deal with one element, the church, the early church. You got development of papacy from 325 to 799. And then you get a growth, depending how you look at it, I'll take the viewpoint, goes from 799 to 1517. Others would say 1378. That's a divided opinion. Then you have the development of Protestantism, which I'll say is from the Reformation announcement 1517 until 1648, and it grows. Like stair steps. Early church develops, grows. Papacy develops, grows. Protestantism develops, grows, and then the Lord comes and judges the whole thing. In here you have the distinction of the seven churches of Revelation. That's why there are, depending how you count, seven periods. There's total agreement on 1, 2, and 3, and 6 and 7. There's almost universal agreement as to what these periods relate to. But 4 and 5, no. One group of thinking says you take the periods 4 and 5 together and mark that 4. And then count 5, 6, 7. And the other to which I subscribe is you leave 4, take 4 and 5 together, and then this becomes 6 and 7. Others say, no, leave 4 and 5 and take the last two, 5 and 6 together, and make that 6. That's just where you put the B's on a chart. It's almost irrelevant. The point is you've got these areas of growth and development. Enough of history. Let's leave history aside for now. And now let's go to the Bible and look at some prophecy. Generally speaking, we look at the second and third chapters of Revelation, or the seven seals, or the seven trumpets. We're not going to do that. That's been gone over enough times. We don't want to repeat that ground again. Interesting as that ground is, and very pertinent as it is. We're going to look at it from the standpoint of Matthew 13. In Matthew 13, you have a series of parables, often called a series of seven parables. Technically, that's not true. There are eight parables in the chapter. But there are seven that relate to each other. And it's these seven parables that we want to notice. Very well-known parables. All are introduced with the kingdom of heaven is like unto. The parables of the kingdom. The sower went out to sow. Number one. The wheat and tares, number two. The mustard seed that grew like a mighty tree, number three. The leaven hidden in a meal that leavened the whole lump, number four. The treasure hidden in the field, number five. The pearl of great price, number six. And the dragnet, number seven. Have you ever notice in these parables that they fall into natural groupings of two? In fact, they're given in groupings of two. Two parables relate to each other, two to each other, two to each other, and one by itself. The first two parables. Well, let's just talk about the wheat and tares 1 second. Wheat and tares, because we're living today, down here, we stress a harvest. In that parable. Sometimes they call it the parable of the harvest. But in the parable, there's equal stress given to the planting of the tares. And I would like to call it, for our purpose today, the parable of the planting of the tares. So both parables, 1 and 2, are planting parables. Planting of the seed, It goes by the wayside, among rocks, whatever. And parable number two is planting of the seed of tares. They're both planting parables. Numbers three and four are both growth parables. The growth of a mustard seed to a great tree, and the growth of leaven, the leaven's the whole lump. They're related in their action. They both deal with the action of growth. Five and six are both treasure parables. A great treasure hid in a field, and a pearl of great price. They're related. Seven is a non-related parable, the dragnet. So even as we saw in the periods of the church, a relationship of the early church, you got two parables dealing with sowing, a relationship of papacy, you got two dealing with growth, and Protestantism, two with the treasure. They match in their relationship to each other. That's the pattern that we wanted to see in the development. Now, looking at the similarities in the parable, let's look at the dissimilarities. How these two in each set, while they are similar in their structure, are different in the lesson. In the first two, the parable of the seed is only that which is good for food. Whether it grows or doesn't grow depends on the ground it's planted in. But its point is that whatever grows, you're free to eat. The parable of the tares is just the opposite. It's the planting of something else. It's the planting of a poisonous weed that is there. You've got two different elements that are being planted. And you have that in these two periods. From 33 to 150, as the Christian church is developing under the apostles, and as soon as they died, under leaders such as Polycarp, you have a development of a relatively pure doctrine. Oh, Paul said, the mystery of iniquity does already work. But it was subdued. It had not yet reached its prominence. It was still in a subdued area. You're looking at a planting of good seed. Now the tares come along, and he tells you when the tares are planted. It said, while men slept, the enemy sowed the tares. That phrase is open to two interpretations, both of which are excellent. Both of which agree with each other. There's no need to choose one or the other. They both elaborate upon different elements. The one looks at the men who planted in the first parable. That was the apostles mainly. Once they had died, control was taken off, and now the church was free to go any direction it went, and errors were planted. I think that's a very true statement. But I think there's a more important lesson for us today in that phrase, while men slept. And that is, when the church, the early church, stopped being on the alert, when it had fallen into a soporific condition, a sleepfulness condition, when it was no longer contesting what was being said and challenging it, but was accepting. And this was pushed on the church. First, it was pushed on the church by the bishops. They said, you are not sufficiently developed to understand what is true, we would tell you. We need to have unity in the church, and if you each decide what is true, we're going to have disunity. Therefore, we would tell you what we'll be unified on. This is our doctrine. This is what we believe. Don't challenge it. It's already been settled. Like the sign I've got my old office. You'll like working here. It's one of the rules. Well, that's sort of the same thing here. You'll like what you're going to believe because that's the law. That's what you're going to believe. Another word for it is creedalism. The development of the creeds. As creeds began developing, and the most important of those was probably the one in 325 that set the church into two camps. Here was a written statement. This is a danger at all times for the church. It can be a danger for us today. There are times when there's an open contest about what a certain scripture teaches, what a viewpoint is. And we can't have this conflict. And we settle it by saying, the majority say. But that doesn't necessarily mean the scriptures say. The majority say is not always. It's good to notice from the standpoint of peace to be cognizant of what the majority says and not to be in our contesting for truth, to be warmongers, but rather peacemakers, and speaking the truth in love. But also it should not stop the search. The search for truth must go on. So while men slept, when they were in this condition of saying, we're not in a position to judge what is right and what is wrong, let the clergy decide it for us. Let the elders decide it for us. Let Brother Russell decide it for us. Let whatever decide it for us. If we make this as the rule, instead of the personal responsibility, there is a sleeping condition that comes in, and that sleeping condition can produce our own crop of tear seeds. That, I think, is a moral lesson from that period of the church. Okay, that covers those first two periods. You've got different seeds sown, a pure seed and impure. The fruitage of the second is not to the end of the age. I guess you brother know me well enough. I like to take a little side roads. Just going to take a little side road real quickly, and we'll come back. It's intriguing in the study of Matthew 13 that the one parable that applies in two very opposite periods is the second parable. It's the parable of the wheat and tares. We apply it to the harvest because that's where we live, and that's what applies to our life. But it also applied to the second period of the church. It was very important to their life because that was when the tares were sown. You go back to the first seven in the Bible, the first set of seven, and you got that same pattern. Seven creative days. After six of the creative days, a statement was made by God. And it was very good. And it was good. He made the light, he saw the light, and it was good. He divided the light from the darkness, it was good. The different things he did, it was good. Except the second day. The second day is the only day God does not say it was good. And there's a simple reason for that. The second day he divided the waters from the waters. Well, he almost did. He divided a large part of them. But he didn't finish it until in the sixth day when the flood came. Then it was good. Then it was completed. It was not completed back then. And so here the second parable is not complete back at that end of the age. It's completed later. Just an interesting pattern that still develops here as well. Let's go to our third and fourth parables. The mustard seed and the leaven. Both parables share in common growth. Rapid growth, all-inclusive growth. But they differ. The mustard seed is external growth. The leaven is internal growth. The leaven works within the lump and grows and puffs the lump. The other is the whole growth of the whole unit. The one is organic growth. The other is a growth that comes with inside. There are two different things that are growing. In the mustard seed, it's the whole tree that grows. The entire unit grows. In the leaven, it's the appearance of the entire thing growing, but it's the leaven that's growing. It's the leaven that's permeating throughout the whole. And so in the third period of the church, the period of the rise of papacy, you have an external growth. Whole nations are converted. Conversion was easy. Take your choice. Become a Christian or die. It wasn't much option given to you. And so many became Christians, or at least took the name upon themselves. Did not really become so. But it wasn't until there was establishment, not until they had thoroughly put out the problem of that period, which was Arianism. They didn't put that out until, what's his name comes on the seed? Photius, in 867. Then you've got the final defeat of Arianism. Now, that is totally put out. Now they can develop all the internal errors, the internal corruption. And that internal corruption develops more and more to overcome the church. In the parable of the leaven, there's a unique feature that is not common to most parables. And that is, there is a specific quantity that is given. Usually they would say you put leaven into meal. But it says here they put leaven into 3 measures of meal. He specifies the number of measures. And I think that becomes important as we see how that pictures this period of the church. To gather the picture of the 3 measures of meal, we need to go back to the law of Israel. With every sacrifice, there was a meal offering that was given. It was the accompanying offering. It was flour, one type or another. Sometimes it was baked, sometimes it was unbaked. Different offerings called for different treatments. But there was a meal offering and a drink offering that went with the actual animal offering. And that meal offering was very specific. Many of the sacrifices that they gave individually depended upon the wealth of the individual. It was a wealthy man sin offering, he gave a bullock. It was a poor man, he gave a goat or even down to a turtle dove. It would vary on certain sacrifices. And so they were told, depending on what sacrifice you give, there is a ratio, a rule, as to how big the meal offering should be. If it's a goat or a lamb, give 1 measure of meal. But if it's a bullock, give 3 measures of meal. 3 measures was the meal offering that went with the offering of a bullock, a perfect sacrifice. A sacrifice we often connect with Jesus. The only really perfect one, the bullock. In fact, it's interesting that when you look at the harvest of Israel, you've got 2 main grain harvests, a barley harvest, followed by a wheat harvest. The barley harvest came first, and it was celebrated by the waving of the barley leaf, sheaf, on the 16th of Nisan, the day of Jesus' resurrection. It pictured Jesus. The wheat harvest was offered on the day of Pentecost, when the church was started. And it was 11 loaves of bread. There was leaven in the loaves for that offering. So the barley pictured Jesus, and wheat pictured the church. In Revelation, you've got this man on the black horse. He's got these balance scales in his hand. He's offering grain for sale. He says, 1 measure of wheat for a penny, but 3 measures of barley. The wheat tying in with the goat, the barley tying in with the bullock, the offering that accompanied Jesus' offering, the offering that goes along with a perfect offering, that's what got corrupted. That's where the leaven grew. That's where this develops. 3 measures becomes a significant feature. Let's go down to the next set of 2 parables. The treasure in the field and the pearl of great price. Here again, you've got similarities. Both are valuable objects. Action is the same. Both are purchased. But you have dissimilarities. In the first parable, he buries it and buys a larger entity to get the treasure. The treasure was only a part of the purchase. He buried it, bought the whole field, and took the treasure. In the second, the pearl, he doesn't bother. He says, I'll give everything I've got for that pearl. And he doesn't get anything along with it. He just gets 1 pearl. There, it's object-oriented, directly to the object. He wants the pearl. The other is general. He buys the whole in order to get the treasure put in the field. This very much fits the 2 stages in development of Protestantism. As the Protestants developed, they saw a beautiful gem of truth that had been lost. Justification by faith. They saw this, they wanted it, but they bought it with a lot of other things. They bought a much larger parcel than that because they had not isolated what this meant. In fact, they had corrupted it. They corrupted it by saying, Everything is grace. So much so that at one time, at least Luther said, I don't want the book of James in the Bible. It's got too much about works. And works is anathema. Everything is grace. It was a corruption. But when you come along to 1648, almost that exact year, you've got a whole new development coming up in Christianity. A works movement of developing a concept of full consecration. It was a movement called Pietism. It started by Spener. It was taken off by the Moravians under Count von Zinzendorf and picking up the teaching of Huss. He developed them during this period, all developing under the concept of a Pietist movement, that there's more to life than merely the belief in God's grace. Justification by faith has become dead orthodoxy. You believe in justification, you're good. You don't believe in it, you're bad. That's not what the Bible is about. You don't simplify it to one teaching. It's like today, we can say, you believe the Lord is present, you're good. You don't believe it, you're bad. We don't decide what's good or bad upon one teaching, one belief. You believe Christ is reigning, you don't believe he's reigning, this is the good camp, that's the bad camp. That's all separating on one thing and becoming self-righteous over a belief instead of letting the truth work from within to develop the overall Christian. There you've got a pearl. And a pearl, you notice, is the one gem that is unique from all other gems. It's the only gem that is not earth-formed, but it is animal-formed. Formed by the oyster, takes the grain of sand, layer upon layer covers it, until we develop the pearl. To the oyster, the pearl is a trial made beautiful. You know, Jesus said, don't cast your pearl before swine. Now, we don't, when we spread the message of the gospel, we don't, if we put a newspaper ad out, ask each person to fix it up, excuse me, are you a swine or not? Before I give you this paper. But we pass it broad spread. We don't make any distinction. We scattershot the whole. But there is a part of the message that we don't cast scattershot. A part that is so precious that we reserve it for those who show themselves worthy to listen to it. That is the truth about a consecrated life. The truth about what this can mean personally to you. When Ezekiel saw the beauties of Ezekiel's temple, he was told, show this plan of that temple to all the nation of Israel, that they may see their iniquity and repent. And to those who do repent, show them all the inner workings, all the plans and all the forms so they may keep them. That's the system. We show the truth to all, spread it wide and clear, to produce the repentance. And to those who are repentant, we show the pearl. The pearl is that gem of consecrated living. That's how we get into the kingdom, through the pearls. And that's why in the New Jerusalem, the gates were pearls. Because they have to be these trials that have turned into something and made an entrance through our living up to the responsibilities of consecration. So there's a distinction between the theological Protestant Reformation and the development of the concept of this not being Calvinistic or predestined, but free grace coming in and the personal responsibility coming out in answer to this promise. And of course, that brings us to the last parable, the dragnet. And that parable is the parable of the harvest. There the fish are already caught. You bring in the net, and now it's a sorting. It's a dividing time. It's sifting time. And brethren, it's the time we're living in. It's a time that is very much about us. It's a time of the judgment of Christendom. That's our seven parables. Now let's look at our three women. We're going to go to an allegory for this. An allegory that covers four chapters in the Bible. Covers Judges chapters 14 Three chapters, 14 to 17. Four chapters. I can't add very well, but four chapters. Judges chapters 14 to 17. It's the life of one of the last judges of Israel. The life of Samson. And to get an interesting perspective of this, we recommend reprint article 4088, in which it's suggested that Samson, throughout his life, represents the Christian church as it develops throughout their experience. It's the whole history of the Christian church. It's interesting when you divide the life of Samson, like you're going to make a movie out of that life. If you take the Bible account only, there are seven scenes in the Bible. There are three women and four slaughters. That is your whole life that's given in the Bible of Samson. We're going to touch just the women. I'll mention the slaughters briefly because they do touch on the overall theme. The first one is a lawfully engaged wife, called the woman of Timnath. I've got to get a point out of a pen, am I? Get the right thing out of my pocket first. The woman of Timnah. She was a Philistine. His parents very strongly disapproved of the marriage. But he legally contracted to marry her until the men of Timnah played some tricks on him and got his anger up. And you saw what happened about the little parable there of the lion's mouth and the honey that grew there on the carcass of the lion. The changes of garments, we won't go into the details of that. But there was this woman who finally, he loses his wife, she's given to another man. And when he finds out that she's given to another man, he goes and, incident number two, he takes a bunch of foxes, ties their tails together, and sends them to the field, and they burn the fields down. Well, the people get angry at that, and they said, why did this happen? Well, because you didn't let him have his wife. So they burned the wife. They killed her. Well, then Samson gets very mad, and he goes out and has another slaughter. That's his second slaughter. Well, then the Philistines strive to make peace. They said, we're going to really conquer Israel hard. They got a big army, and people of Judah say, why are you coming against us? Because of Samson. Deliver Samson, and all is okay. So they tie Samson up with two fresh cords, and they deliver him. Of course, he breaks the cords, takes the jawbone of an ass, and then you've got your next slaughter with the jawbone of an ass where he killed so many that way. Then you've got the second woman in his life, got the harlot of Gaza. He goes, they got him trapped in their city of Gaza. They're going to take him to prison in the morning, and during the night he gets up and takes the whole gates of the city with him, carries him all the way to Hebron, 35 miles away, puts him on a big hill and says, there's your city and your strength, and leaves him there. Then he gets the third woman, Delilah. And this is the one, of course, that most time is spent on. And he's tricked into the Delilah experience. So he is captured. His hair is shorn. He comes weak. And he goes through the experience of having to drag a millstone like an animal would drag a millstone, like a donkey or an ass would drag a millstone, until his hair grows back, and then the final slaughter. But these three women represent the same thing we've been seeing, the development of three stages of the church. The Christian church has been associated with three different churches. The early church was associated with the Church of Judaism. It was an outgrowth of Judaism. It took a while for it to break free from Judaism. It was a legally contracted arrangement. It was legitimately from Judaism and related to Judaism. And when the Jews did not turn, their fields were burned. In fact, it's interesting, they're burned by foxes. One of the foxes' name is in the Bible. Herod, Jesus tells who it is. Herod, that old fox. All these leaders were tied together, and they're the ones, the non-Jewish leaders, that brought down the polity of Israel. They're the ones that caused that to be burned. But then those who bring it down go too far, and they persecute the Jews as well. They take away the nation of Israel. That woman is killed. And that makes him very angry. And this time he goes out, there's another slaughter. Hippothites, that's the rock of Etam. And it's interesting, I forget now, I looked it up earlier today about the rock of Etam. but its meaning ties in very directly with this. I have to skip that. My memory just hit a blank spot. Then you come to the taking a tribute that they were taking and saying, we want to maintain our relationship and power. Deliver to us the Samson class. And that's something you find happening by the papal church during this period. There's a delivering of the class of the truly consecrated ones. But what erupts out of that is a development that you couldn't describe any better than the jawbone of an ass. You've got the Waldenses, the Albigenses, Wycliffe, the discarded of the church, who through the foolishness of preaching went out and destroyed spiritually those who were attacking them. The jawbone, the preaching, answering the foolishness of preaching, that it wasn't so foolish, it accomplished its work, and you have this slaughter. That puts in alliance now Samson with Gaza through the papal experience. A harlot, that's what it's called, the mother of harlots. And that doesn't fall until the Reformation. And there, the very ability to judge the gates of the city are taken from them. And no longer can they issue a bull, an edict, in Rome, and have it throughout the world. That whole option of issuing the edict and being enforced is gone. The gates are removed from that city. And people begin streaming out of the city, in fact. And then comes along Delilah, the allurements of Protestantism. And these allurements become very tempting to the church. And as they become tempting, they begin losing their spirituality and their power. Modernism comes in. Social gospel comes in. All these elements come in. You want a detail? Look at Jeremiah 8th chapter. It describes it in great detail of all the developments that come in at this period of time. And as a result, the true church loses its power for a while. But Samson's hair is growing again. And the time will come when the final conflict will come, when the judgment will fall, and when that judgment falls, the whole house will collapse. It will mean not only the end of the social order, it will also mean, as it did to Samson, the end of his career on earth. It'll be the final conclusion of that period. It makes an interesting parallel from the Old Testament with the things we're seeing of how the Christian church is developing. So in closing, we want to summarize. We've done a lot of historic review. We've gone over a period of 2,000 years in less than an hour. You can't do justice in a short time. But we have seen how the same principle that God uses in the judgment of nations, he uses in the judgment of religious societies. He gives them every opportunity to try it their way. That's why you had the development of four world empires. To try the Babylonian method, the Medo-Persian method, the Grecian and the Roman. That's why you got the development of three different churches. The Judaic, the early church was developed when the man-child was born with the papal and the Protestant. And that's why when the judgment is taken, either the secular or the religious, the answer is the same. Meni, meni, tekel, upharsin. Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting.